your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to the Alchemy Podcast, where we're on a quest to explore the intersection of cannabis, compliance, and creative in the marketing world today and beyond. Welcome back to another episode of Alchemy. Joining me today, Andrew D'Angelo, co-founder at Harborside. And Harborside is a California-focused cannabis company that has retail production and cultivation operations. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Really honored to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be with your listeners today.
Yeah, so, you know, I got to tell you, I have so many questions for you. So it was kind of hard to figure out where to start. But, you know, I think I wanted to begin first with Harborside. You know, Harborside was one of the first six dispensaries licensed in the U.S., which is pretty amazing because you've been around the block a few times. So I would love for you to talk to our listeners right now just a little bit about the story behind it and really how it's grown and diversified since its inception.
Sure, I'd love to. One of my favorite stories to tell.
Great.
So many of your listeners may be familiar with my older brother, Steve D'Angelo, and he's known as the father of the legal cannabis industry. And Steve and I have been doing this a long time now, as you mentioned. So, and Steve's 10 years older than me. So when, by the time Steve was 20 and I was only 10 years old, Steve was had already spent almost a decade, you know, six or seven years doing cannabis at that point. And so I sort of grew up in cannabis and in the very early days when I was a teenager, just smoking weed with Steve, we would dream of the day that cannabis would be legal and we could have a shop and we could have the public come in and we could, you know, share our cannabis with the world. And it would be, you know, a normal everyday thing, just like going to the health food store or the, you know, something like that. And we cultivated these dreams and talked about them a lot. And, you know, the journey from the 70s and 80s to opening Harborside in 2006 took a lot of different twists and turns. But ultimately, we found ourselves in Northern California, in the Bay Area, the city of Oakland, in 04, 05, the city of Oakland decided after Prop 215 passed in 96, you know, the city of Oakland in 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001 was overrun by people opening dispensaries. And some of the operators were not very good. There wasn't any regulations in place. There wasn't any licensing. It was sort of the wild, wild west. And a lot of these dispensaries were run by criminal organizations that were using the newly passed law to sort of move bulk out the back door, or they were run by, you know, well-intentioned activists who didn't know a lot about running a retail business. And so the city of Oakland was sort of fed up with that and decided that they were going to shut everybody down and then just issue a limited number of licenses to a select group of folks that, you know, had to go through an application process and meet certain specs that the city deemed necessary that everybody meet. And they did a public, you know, it was open to everybody and it was, you know, a subject of public hearings. And they were the first municipality to license cannabis retail under the medical framework in California. And of course, in those days, California was the only state that had any framework whatsoever. It wasn't until 2012 that Colorado and Washington came along. And it was not until 2008 or 2009 that Colorado and Washington did the medical. So in 05, 06, when Oakland did this, it was very much a pioneering thing for a city and a municipality to do. And it was a dream come true for me and Steve to be able to apply. So we worked really hard to get the application and all the resources and partnerships and landlords and buildings and, you know, weed and other things we needed together to apply for the license. And we were fortunate enough to get the license. And once that happened, we were able to execute a vision that we had cultivated for a long time. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So that's how we got a license. And then, you know, in those days, it was a nonprofit medical framework. And then it took us all the way until 2016 to change the law in California so that it was an adult use law. And now anyone over the age of 21 can come into the dispensary and purchase cannabis. And we're now, the market is largely for profit now. And, you know, legalization has not gone well in California. Prop 64 is really flawed. The flaws that we feared were in it have proven to be even bigger on the ground as we've implemented 64. I actually have an article I wrote about this today in Benzinga. People can read, and it's been 2 years since Prop 64, and we're really at a crossroads there. And in some respects, you know, things were, in many respects, things were more inclusive and worked better under the medical framework and nonprofit framework. So we have a lot to do to fix it, and the Harborside, you know, is leading the charge on that, as we always have. Activism and reform and change and making cannabis more accessible has always been in our DNA. It's always been part of me and Steve's mission, and it continues. And you know, Harborside's a publicly traded company on the Canadian Stock Exchange now. That was something that we both did by choice, but sort of had to do a little bit too. And that changes any company that goes through that process. So we've certainly grown up a lot in the last 13 years, and you know, I think I'm very proud of our legacy, and I'm proud of our what message we've really helped rebrand cannabis as something good, not bad, and something that brings benefits, not harms, to communities.
I mean, listen, you've been in the cannabis world now for over 30 years. And really have played a pretty crucial part of not just the movement and the legalization, but also the activism around it. So, you know, I think from an activist, you know, perspective, like what does that mean, like, to truly be an activist in this space?
Well, it's meant different things over the years. So first, you know, it meant legalizing, changing the laws, ending prohibition. That was really our first task. Being a criminal was not something I liked. I loved cannabis, and I had to trade in cannabis because I wanted to learn about it, and I consumed an awful lot of it. and trading in it was a way to learn about it and consume a lot of it too without bankrupting yourself. And it also provided a way to finance activism, to change the law, so you're not, you know, being a criminal, which is not a lifestyle that I liked and enjoyed. So we worked very hard and spent a lot of our own money to change laws and to be activists. Now that the laws have changed, if where you live, the laws haven't changed, like New York still has to change the law, that's the activism we have to do. You know, that we mentioned off air a moment ago, the disconnect between the fact that anywhere in the five boroughs of New York, or pretty much anywhere in the whole state of New York, even in rural areas of New York, within a few minutes, maybe an hour or two, you can score some pretty good cannabis, and a variety of different forms of cannabis. You want a vape pen, you can get a vape pen. You want some flower, you can get flower. You want a pre-roll joint, you probably get that too.
And for a while too. I mean, it's been going on now for years.
Oh yeah, like, since the 90s when I was doing work in New York, it was, you get the delivery services were just starting to proliferate in the 90s, in those days. And that was 25 years ago. So that part of our community has done a very good job to create access, right? But then on the other hand, it's all illegal. It's all, you know, illicit. I think you have decriminalization there, and you have some,
yeah, sure.
And there's some medical that's very, very constrained. And that's it. And New York, culturally, the cannabis that you have there is excellent. It's well distributed. It's all over the place. Everybody takes it. but the legal situation is a total disconnect from that. And so our jobs as activists is first and foremost to change the laws. And sometimes your first act of activism is just coming out of the cannabis closet, to your family or to your parents or to your wife or spouse or coworkers or boss, and just say, hey, look, this is part of my life, and you know, it's going to stay a part of my life, and you need to deal with it. And having that conversation is often our first act of activism, and sometimes our most vulnerable act, because you're actually risking judgment of your most immediate community and family. So that's how it starts for all of us. You just say, you know what, I'm going to be upfront with myself and the world about this, and I'm going to come out of the closet. And that's our first act of activism. It feels good to do that, and you find that you're good at it, and that the world's responding. You know, certainly there's a no shortage of ways to plug in to either make cannabis legal in a place like New York or here in California, fix legalization to make sure it works better for everybody, so that, you know, people who actually have sacrificed for the plant in California can benefit from legalization, and that the whole industry isn't owned by Canadians and you know, people who don't live in California. And New York can learn a lot from our mistakes, and I hope you will. So, you know, activism is part of the work all of us have to do now, because prohibition has just been so brutal and so long. And I wish we didn't have to do it, because it sucks. It's not fun work at all. Politics is dirty business, but it's necessary.
Yeah. So I've got a fun question for you. So, you know, the Discovery Channel actually featured you and Steve on your reality TV series Weed Wars. So I was just curious, you know, if you could maybe talk to us a little bit about the show and really the purpose behind it.
Right. Well, you've never lived your life to the fullest until you've been on a reality TV show. What can I say? It's the Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame on steroids sort of model. But in our case, we really did try to use that format to do something more important than just, you know, do a reality TV show. We wanted, it was the very first reality TV show about cannabis. At that time, California was the only legal cannabis state, and for our medical program, and Colorado and Washington had just done so, but they didn't really have anything up and running the way California did in terms of dispensaries and so forth when we filmed Weed Wars. And so it was risky. First of all, we had to decide whether we were gonna, you know, the feds were busting people in those days and raiding dispensaries, and, you know, they were at war with us. And it's hard for us to imagine now how intense that was, but it was risky to go on television and show the fact that you own a dispensary and that you operate it and you're selling weed and you're in a vault full of weed and full of money. And we showed all of that. We were very transparent with that. And of course, the Discovery people, you know, you go into the vault and, yeah, could you show us more of the money? And could you show us more of the weed? And, you know, that's, you know, what's exciting for them, because that part of it was sort of the sexy part of it. But we wanted to show, we wanted to inspire activists. Just like we were talking about a second ago, we wanted people all over the world to see that, hey, if the D'Angelo brothers and our family and our team can do this, you can too. And you can bring this to your community, and you can change the laws, and you can create regulation and licensing, and you can have a harbor side of your own. And it's risky and it's difficult work, but it's within reach and it can be done. At the end of the day, growing and trading cannabis is not that complicated a thing to do. We've been doing it for millions of years, or at least tens of thousands of years. And it's one of the most ancient, it's in our muscle memory. It's in our endocannabinoid system. It's evolved with us. So it's a very natural thing for us to do, to trade in cannabis. So the purpose of the show was to create more change and to inspire people to get up and stand up for their rights. And you know, legalization doesn't get handed to us. We have to fight for it, and we have to go get it and grab it and call it our own. And you have to do that everywhere. And if you don't do that work, you end up in a situation like New York, where, you know, there's a big gap between what's happening on the ground and what's happening in the law. And unfortunately, a whole bunch of people end up in prison, you know, is what happens. And then a whole bunch of other people are too scared to have cannabis in their lives.
You're in particular, like, you're on a mission yourself to free, you know, every cannabis prisoner on the planet.
Yes. The Last Prisoner Project, Steve and I, and a whole bunch of other really talented, beautiful human beings started the Last Prisoner Project last year, and we've gathered some very nice momentum. People can learn all about what we do at lastprisonerproject.org. And if you're in the industry, we've got programs for you to help us get people out of prison. If you're not in the industry, there's petitions to sign and small donations that you can make. And we're not the only group doing social justice for cannabis prisoners or for, you know, just war on drugs prisoners, or prisoners in general. We lock up far too many people in this country. You know, it's an outrageous wrong that we've got a legal industry. We've got publicly traded cannabis companies. All of us that are in the legal industry, we're buying and selling weed. We're growing weed. We're transporting weed. We're manufacturing weed. So it's, and all the people in prison are there for the same thing. And it's outrageous. And we have to, it just doesn't feel right to continue any longer without doing something about it. So Steve and I and our team are working to get people out. So we work on clemency. We work on expungement. So clemency is you're in prison and you have to get out, but you've already been convicted. And the only way you can get out is the governor or the president has to pardon you and issue clemency. If you're already out, but you have a record, that's called expungement, and that's when your record gets erased so that it doesn't follow you around, so you can get an apartment, you can get a job, and you can get benefits and things like that that records often prevent people from doing. And then we try to reintegrate people who have recently gotten out and had their records expunged and try to get them a job. We have a training program with Harvest, which is a multi-state operator, and we're working with them to train prisoners that are released and get them hired into the legal cannabis industry. So the Last Prisoner Project is one of these things where you can put your time and energy into it, and you know it's doing something right. You know it's doing something good. So often the activism that we do to legalize cannabis is frustrating because you try to get it done and it fails. You run a bill in Albany and it fails. You run a bill in Sacramento and it fails, and you'll lose, and it's demoralizing. But with the Last Prisoner Project, you know, every time we help get people released, we've done something significant. And I do believe that, you know, this year we're going to get at least one, maybe more of our lifers out, people that are serving life terms for cannabis for doing nothing more than selling, and sometimes a very small amount of cannabis. And it's one of those things you can work on that there's nowhere to go but up. You know,
totally.
You know, there's nowhere to go but up once you're in prison for cannabis. That's about as low as it gets for a human being to be caged for their relationship to cannabis. So that's what Last Prisoner Project does. We're very passionate about it, and I hope everyone listening is too. Our work is not done till they're all free.
I think that's great, and definitely something that's needed out there. From a kind of looking back and, you know, looking at your career the last 30 years. And, you know, I think just from everything that I've seen of and read of, you know, everything that you've done in the space from a leadership perspective to activism, you know, you're really committed to telling stories that really change the hearts and minds of the world around cannabis. And I'm just curious from you, kind of looking into the lens of the future a little bit, do you see this as like, hey, cannabis is going to be legalized globally? Like, when do you think that we're going to see something like that?
Well, we're already seeing it. I just had somebody reach out to me from Portugal who needs genetics because they've recently legalized medical there, and she's going to get a license, and I'm going to help her, you know, try to find some genetics. So it's already happening. It's happening more slowly than we would like. It's certainly not happening in East Asia like I would like to, or China, or Malaysia, or places like the Philippines, where it's just crazy and very, very dark times for cannabis people in some of those places. But there are other places like Colombia and Mexico and Uruguay and Chile and, you know, Portugal and Spain, and that are very exciting places for cannabis. Even Australia and South Africa are starting to come alive a little bit. Some of the frameworks in those places are not where we need them to be, or totally absurd, but they're there. They're something. And, you know, I like bold change. I don't like incremental change, but oftentimes I've had to live with incremental change, because that's oftentimes the way change happens. And so I think we're in the middle of that globalization of legalization. But things like a pandemic is going to slow it down. And that's, you know, this is a good opportunity for us to get our strategies together to flip places like New York. And, you know, I know, and places like China, you know, those are a place like China's much farther down the road than a place like New York. But it's all the same struggle. It's all the same movement to free the plant. So,
yeah, well, I think, you know, it's definitely in progress. And, you know, like we were chatting before the show, I think with this whole pandemic and, you know, states needing money, this is a great way to, you know, light a fire under people's ass and in politics and get it done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, okay, what's more dangerous? Cannabis or coronavirus, you know, and any reasonable human being, you know, puts those two things on opposite ends of the scale and starts thinking about where we need to put our resources. Cannabis prohibition just ain't one of them. When you're and you know, the domino effect of this virus on tax revenue, which is, you know, one of the areas we talked about where there'll be openings for change. Because all this bans and all this, I don't want a dispensary in my neighborhood, all that stigma is built on lies. And this virus doesn't lie, man. It is no joke. It's not a lie, and it's not built on a house of cards. And it's going to have very real, very hard effects for all of us, all of us. And so what, we're not going to let weed into every neighborhood in America after all this is over, really? You're really going to prevent that access from happening, really? So I think that, you know, it something like this changes the conversation for cannabis. It changes the conversation for all kinds of things, you know? Are we going to keep burning coal like we did before after this? A pandemic doesn't have anything to do with the energy, what energy choices we make per se, but, you know, it's nice that there's 10% less emissions the last month than there have been in 20 years, you know?
I think a lot of people are starting to adapt and learn of like, wow, this, maybe the planet did need to be reset. Maybe there are things that we're doing that we need to do away with, right? As we see some substantial changes that impact the environment in such a short period of time.
Yeah, I think this is going to not just reset cannabis, the cannabis conversation. I think it's going to reset a lot of conversation. I certainly hope so. I've been waiting since I was a young teenager and I first started taking cannabis to, I've been waiting for sort of the world to catch up to that realization. But you know, that's what I hope. But, you know, it's very early in all of this, and gosh, no one has a crystal ball. I wish and no one can really tell all the things that are going to happen. I think we need to just have a lot of compassion for each other and cooperate as much as we can. And I think it, those two lessons that cannabis teaches us to are the best things to apply to this situation, I think.
Definitely. So Andrew, the way that we do the show is, you know, we talk a little bit about, you know, business and culture, and then we kind of end the show with some fun quick fire questions.
All right. Okay. Sometimes I struggle with these. Let's see how we go. Okay.
All right. Let's go. Craziest thing you've ever done.
The craziest thing I've ever done. Wow. We're talking about a crazy person here who's done a lot of crazy things. And I got to figure out one I can share with.
Well, we already have an explicit rating on our podcast, so you could say anything, really. There's no filter.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll tell an old cannabis story. That's interesting. One of the things that you had to have in those early days in the 70s and 80s and 90s before we were able to change laws, it was very risky to be in the cannabis trade. And I remember on a couple of occasions, me and my brother traded in a ton of cannabis. So we had a transaction that involved a ton of cannabis, which was 2,200 pounds of cannabis.
And, wow.
And that would be delivered in a tractor trailer to a warehouse that we would rent, you know, and I would have all these different layers of security and, you know, front organ, you know, different ways of concealing all of this. But it was the biggest adrenaline rush of my life has been unloading those trucks into those warehouses and then, you know, taking us a very large amount of cannabis and redistributing it to a bunch of smaller safe houses so that, you know, we had redundancies built into our strategic supply. That was kind of a pretty crazy thing to do, looking back on it. And I remember just unloading those trucks and not being able to hear anything but the sound of my own heartbeat just thumping, 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 and the adrenaline just pulsing, pulsing, pulsing through you. So, that was a pretty crazy thing I did.
What's your favorite cannabis product?
You know, I'm in middle age now. In the old days, I would have answered that question with Neville's Haze. Give me a nice fat bud of Neville's Haze and let me roll that thing up and smoke a nice fat spliff. That would have been my favorite. And when I say spliff, I don't mix anything with tobacco. It's all cannabis. And I loved finger hash and water hash made from Neville's Haze. That was my favorite strain. But now that I'm a little bit older, I have to eat a lot more of my cannabis. So there's a group out here called Prana, and they make some capsules that are whole plant extracts without any solvents used, and basically is the cleanest and most pure cannabis product I know of on earth. So I'm very lucky because the founders of that company and I are friends, and so I'm able to sort of have the inside track on that. But
cool.
So I take that's my favorite product these days, and I take somewhere between 200 and 600 milligrams a day of those capsules, different combination of cannabinoids to sort of that's. And then I do inhale cannabis in the evening still, you know, mostly hash and concentrates.
Cool. So if you had to describe the color blue to a blind person, how would you do that?
I would have them put their hands in water. And I would ask them to feel water, and I would change the temperature of water, and I might change textures.
There you go. Good one.
And then ask them, you know, if a color came to them, some folks in that condition can actually perceive color in their mind's eye and some can't. And if they could not, you know, I guess I would have to try to describe what that concept is and see if they could guess based on how it felt. But you can't really touch or hear the sky, right? Which was the kind of blue that I would want to describe. But blue water, you know, feels like a nice second. And I always would want to come in through a different sense, you know, because when you lose one sense, often the other senses are more heightened. So that's how I would do it.
It was a very, very good one. Well, Andrew, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And, you know, I just wanted to thank you, you know, just in particular on all of the things that you've done for the industry and all the activism and all the great work that you've done to allow for so many businesses to thrive today. So, you know, really appreciate you coming on. Honored to have you on the show. And thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be on Alchemy.
Awesome.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in, and if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.